Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are honoring a wonderful scientist, former guest to our show, and leader in the marine mammal field, the late Lewis Herman. Dr. Herman recently passed on August 3rd at the age of 86, leaving a legacy of research. His groundbreaking work showed that dolphins could respond to language and inspired many. Over the next hour, we will get to hear from the people closest to Dr. Herman and learn more about his amazing work, life, and accomplishments. First up is Dr. Hannah Herman, Lew's wife, to talk about the early years. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thanks very much, Carly.
I'm so glad to hear that you are, so glad to have you here today. And I know this has been an emotional time for you and your family, and really appreciate you being here. So let's just start from the beginning and let's go back. You know, for those listeners who aren't familiar with your husband's work, can you kind of give us just an overview of what Lew did?
Well, you know, Lew, in most of his career, because he did have another career a little bit before, he, of course, worked with dolphins and humpback whales, and he created what became the world-famous Koala Basin Marine Mammal Laboratory, and where he did groundbreaking work studying sensory processes as sort of the fundamental underlying things that he felt he needed to do in order to discover more about the cognitive processes of dolphins, which I think was his main interest. And, you know, that was a time when most people knew of John Lilly's work in dolphins. That was probably the most well-known stuff. But Lew was basically a scientist, and he felt that we needed scientific evidence for some of the claims that people were making. So he started that laboratory in the late 60s. We probably talk about how that came about. Mm-hmm. And then he initiated the earliest work here in humpback whales in the Hawaiian Islands. And I know it's hard for most people to believe, but back in the day, in the 70s, people were not aware that humpback whales were here. And, of course, they were here in much fewer numbers. So.
Sure.
Broadly, that's what he worked on. He worked on the migration of the humpback whales and the behavior and identifying them and all that.
And he legitimized or gave a lot of research to the marine mammal field. I mean, you talk about most people knowing John Lilly's work. Now, John Lilly's work was pretty controversial with some of his studies, which are pretty famous. But Lew, I think Lew took a really unique approach and did some really interesting work with dolphin cognition. Now, when he first got here, I mean, you moved with him to Hawaii.
Yeah,
when
sure.
was that, and what got you here?
We came in 1966, and he had actually started out, he got his doctorate at Penn State in really information processing when cognition was really, cognitive processes were not something people really thought about very much, certainly with animals. It was mm-hmm. the time of, you know, the behavioral Skinnerian approach to things, stimulus response.
Yeah.
And so Lew's doctoral dissertation was really, again, sort of a forefront thing in information processing and working with humans, adults, college students, of course, at that time. And in simultaneous processing of tasks and that sort of thing. Anyway, he was basically very interested in cognition. And that dissertation won him a national award, first prize National Creative Talent Award, because, again, it was kind of a groundbreaking research at the time.
Yeah.
And so that award kind of gave him a new perception of who he was. He never thought of himself as an academic. And so he applied for his first academic job. And then, for various reasons, so he was still doing his human information. We ended up in Hawaii. He loved the ocean. He is a kid who grew up in the beach in New York City. He spent many years as a lifeguard on famous Rockaway Beach that had thousands of people with rescues year after year. And he loved that.
Yeah.
And, you know, till the very end, just a few months before he died, he regularly swam with lifeguards who had also been from the East Coast, and they would get together and swim out at Ala Moana Beach and then go for coffee and still regale each other with their lifeguard stories as well as other things. And that he just loved the ocean. So coming to Hawaii was for him sort of a natural to try it out.
Yeah.
And we thought it'd be a fun thing to do for a couple of years. Because, you know, in the 60s, Hawaii was like the end of the earth. When I told the people where I was working in New York that I was going here, they said, Hannah, that's a place where people go to visit. It's not a place where people live. I mean, it just seemed like it was another world. So we came here, and he was working with one of his assignments was to teach an undergraduate course in experimental psychology. And they each student had a rat. And, you know, he was teaching them, basic operant conditioning techniques, et cetera. Anyway, just to skip to how he shift fields, one of the graduate students, I think, and he was teaching some graduate courses, I don't even remember exactly what in, said to him, why isn't anybody studying like dolphins? We're out here in the Pacific, and they're around. And I think he said, And then all of a sudden, I said, yeah. And in a way, it was a natural fit for him.
Sure.
Because of his love of the ocean. And so he thought, okay, I'm going to think, you know, Lou was always, if you gave him a challenge or he was drawn to it, he's going to come up with a solution. Anyway, it's kind of a long story, but he went out to Sea Life Park to see if they would give him dolphins. And Tap Pryor was running it at that time. And he said no. And Lou went out again, and he said no. And one day, Lou found out he was out at Kaneohe, you know, the island out there.
Yeah, Coconut Island.
And he tracked him down, and he finally said, okay, I give up. You know, Lou was so persistent. And he got two dolphins that summer and did a project with graduate students. And the Navy came by and said, if you find a place, we'll provide you with some dolphins. And he searched and searched. I don't know if you want to hear the story about what he found, but he found the place at Kualoa Basin, you know, which had been a shark show. A private person owned that facility.
See, I never knew that. That's new information.
Oh, you don't know that? Okay, so they were having, and they would get the kids who were surfing right off, you know, Kualoa Basin there to come in and swim with the sharks. And people would come in and pay money to see this. And then people got bitten. And so he couldn't get any more surfers. And so he left the place. He just skipped town. The sharks died. And that was the end of that. And the place, the government, the state and city were using it to keep materials there just as a storage place.
Sure.
When Lou knocked on the door and they said, well, we're going to be out of here soon. And there was a Alfred Tesser, who's a well-known professor, had one tank with the sharks and then Lou had the other. And that's how it started.
Wow, that's, you know, you hear stories and then little bits and more pieces
together. I mean, it wasn't like he just went down there. He looked and looked. Yeah. And I mean, I remember we couldn't believe it. There's actually tanks there.
Gotcha.
And they could actually accommodate. And
wow. So once you set up the Kualoa Marine Lab, tell us about what that process was like. I mean, he had two dolphins to start?
Yeah, the Navy gave him two dolphins. And he had his first marine mammal graduate student, which happened to be Frank Beach. And I don't know how many people know that, but Frank Beach Sr. was a really famous animal psychologist whom Lou knew. But, I mean, he was a very prominent. And his son was a great guy, not quite like his father. And we used to say years after, we can still find the beer cans of Frank Beach at the lab. And so, you know, there's another story. I mean, so Frank Beach Sr. came to the lab and said, Lou, if you can get my son a degree, I'll be forever grateful. And he did. He was his first graduate student in learning sets in dolphins. And years later, Lou, and along with, I guess, Matthias and Adam Pack, did a project that won a prize, the Frank Beach Award at American Psychological Association. And so it was the Frank Beach Senior Award, and Lou thanked everyone for the award and said to Frank Beach, who was dead then, we're even now. Yeah. So he started with Frank doing, you know, very basic stuff to see, you know, what could dolphins do. I mean, he didn't know. Nobody really knew. And, I mean, that was the beginning. And then it just from there, he studied sensory processes. I mean, he wanted to get at the fundamental, basic things.
Sure.
You know, vision, hearing, what could they do in air, underwater. And then he went on to the more dramatic stuff, which was, you know, the memory stuff, the cognitive stuff, the language learning stuff.
Sure. And that work, you know, really spurred so many students and so many other projects. Do you have any idea of how many students came through the Kualo Marine
how
Lab?
How many students? I'm trying to think. I think he had 40-plus doctoral students who got their doctorates, which I don't know if you realize that's a very big number.
That's a huge number. Yeah. I realize how big that is.
Because there are people, I remember we were saying, who had put out one or two of years. So he was putting them in. And I don't know how many master students.
Yeah. And he had a lot of notoriety, too. I mean, there was New York Times articles, Robin Williams visited.
Oh, you know, documentaries, movies. He was featured in two IMAX movies, one called The Discoverers, where, you know, they just featured three people. And for him, it was the dolphin language work, which was featured. And there was a lot of fun. We went to the opening and, you know, I mean, so we had a lot of fun stuff. And doing all that. But, the work got worldwide reporting.
Attention, yeah,
all over. I mean, magazines, everything, yeah.
So there were so many different projects that he worked on. Did he have a favorite? What was his, you know?
You know, Lou loved the process and the discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, of course, the language work got the most fame. But I think he loved all. And one story, Aaliyah was reminding me, he was giving a talk. I don't know, at one conference, and Richard Connor actually told us this story. And Lou had submitted a paper and was presenting. I don't remember what it was. And he got up there and he said, "I'm not going to talk about this. Forget this. We have just been working on this most amazing stuff." And it was the initial television work where the dolphins immediately responded to these tiny images on TV. You know, they used to be, they were, of course, used to getting information from their the human trainers. But the dolphins, they put cameras under the water, and they were tiny images, small. And the dolphins immediately responded to the signals from these little images. And, you know, kids have a hard time with that. Lots of animals, I mean, they don't make that recognition. It was very dramatic. And he was so excited about that. He said, "Forget what I was going to talk to you about. I'm going to tell you about what we're just working on," which hadn't been written up, hadn't been peer-reviewed. So I think he was excited about the process. Like, whatever was going on, he was a terrifically keen observer. So I think, you know, he could pick up stuff and take it new places. I don't know. He had that ability. So I don't know that there were, he just was excited about the process and the discovery, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned Aaliyah Herman, that's, you know, your daughter, and she also works in the marine mammal world and is a friend of mine. And I can only just imagine, you know, what growing up in your house was like. Like, dinnertime conversations would be like, "So, what'd you do today, honey?" "I don't know. I made this groundbreaking discovery about dolphin cognition." Like, you know, it must have been such an amazing experience.
You know, the truth is, it was our life. So people always say, wasn't when Lou said he's going to do this or who's going to do that. It was just what we did.
Yeah.
So it didn't seem so amazing to me. I remember someone, when he said, "You know, I hear there are humpback whales out in the ocean. I've been talking to some fishermen." Honestly, people didn't know that. He said, "I think we should rent a helicopter, fly over to Maui, and see if that's true." I said, "Oh, okay." You know, it wasn't like, "Oh, my God, this is amazing. That's what we're going to do." So we flew to Maui. We rented a helicopter. We went out in the ocean. And I will never forget. We looked, "Oh, my God, who never seen a humpback whale? Never seen any whale." And to see them in the water. And we said, "Oh, my God." And next year, he had a whale camp on Lanai. He started the flights, doing population studies. In other words, he somehow was able, there's an opportunity, and make something out of it. He had that skill.
Sure. And now, I mean, it wasn't all positive times. You had two dolphins from the marine lab, Puka and Kea, that were stolen in 1977. And I bring this up only because it was such a big case and received so much attention globally. How did Lou overcome that?
You know, of course, there's no getting around it. It was a devastating thing to happen. But, you know, a year later, we had new dolphins. The lab was refurnished, and we had new dolphins. And you can't imagine how hard that was, how people fought certain, you know, who had been involved in that to not have that happen. But if, I think everyone would say this. There are a couple of things everyone say about Lou. First of all, that he influenced so many people. He had this amazing influence on thousands of people came through.
Sure.
But I think most everyone would say he was one of the most resilient people. You know, you knock him down. He said, okay. You know, we prosecuted that. There was convictions. You know, it was hard. And, you know, it was very difficult. I remember during one of the trials, they had some, one of the local stations had a guy saying that Lou was training dolphins to kill. And we had to go hear that. And, it was so bizarre and so nuts. I mean, this facility, which in those days was really so open.
Yeah.
But he just... We're going to push on, and we're going to get new dolphins, and we're going to start again. And we're going to make it even better because these will be naive dolphins, which was true, you know. And he just forged ahead. And, of course, the lab became more famous. More and more people came. There were constantly visitors, you know, besides all the students, the interns. And he just always went on. There were many obstacles along the way and many things, but... He always was able to bounce back. I mean, that was just a quality of his.
And I think, you know, his passion for marine mammals and for the research that he did was evident in the amount of research that he produced and how long he kept going. I mean, even in retirement, there were still papers being produced and
he won an award for, you know, most productive retiree or something in social sciences. No, he never stopped working. I mean, he loved what he did at the lab and he loved working with the animals. He also loved writing. He loved putting it together and writing it up. And so he continued to work till the end.
Yeah. Well, Hannah, I know it wasn't easy to come onto the show today and so soon after Lou's passing. I really do appreciate you being here today and my deepest condolences for
your
loss.
Thank you, Carly, and thank you for honoring him
by
doing this.
He contributed a lot to the marine mammal world. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're actually going to speak with some of Lou's former students.
Okay, thanks very much, Carly.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a time out for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Today, we are remembering the famed dolphin scientist, the late Dr. Lou Herman. Moving to Lou's mid-career, we have Dr. Joe Mobley to share his experiences and research. Dr. Mobley is a professor at the University of Hawaii and a former student of Dr. Herman's. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you for joining us today, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
So we just had a chance to talk with Hannah about the Kualo Marine Lab and some of Lou's early work. Why don't you tell us how you first met Dr. Herman and some of your first impressions?
Well, I came to Hawaii as a fresh graduate student in 1978, and I had just done my master's thesis working out at Marine World Africa, USA, when it was located in Redwood City, California. And there was, you know, four dolphins there, and so I actually was one of few applicants, I think, at that time that had some experience working with dolphins. And when I got here, it was a very different place in 1978 than it is now. At that time, the Koala-based Marine Mammal Lab, you know, under Lou's direction, had just acquired two bottlenose dolphins, So they were fresh arrivals. They'd just been there, I think, for a couple of months. Akea Kamai and Phoenix. And those two went on to become, you know, stars in the language training project that he did. And I remember meeting him at the door. He seemed kind of like an intense guy. And he kept looking at me with a scowl on his face. And he concluded our little brief interview with, I'll get back to you. I'm not sure that, you just stay in touch, but we'll let you know when you can come back. And I wasn't allowed in the lab for about 2 or 3 weeks. And I found out subsequently is because he had a bad feeling about me because I looked like one of the two dolphin thieves. Stolen Puka and Kea. So once somebody pointed out to him, I think it was Paul Forrestal that said, you know, hey, Lou, you know, he looks just like so-and-so. You know, he's just like, oh, you're right. All right, bring him back. So I finally was allowed in the lab. So, it was definitely, you know, he was definitely reeling still from the whole dolphin theft thing. And, understandably so. But it was a very fresh time, you know, bringing in these two brand new dolphins who were, you know, naive. They'd never been used in, any kind of cognitive studies before. It was very magic back then.
Sure. Actually,
yeah.
So did you have a working relationship with Akea Kamai and Phoenix? And what projects were you working on once you were allowed back in the lab?
Well, I was privileged enough to actually get involved in the very beginning of the language training with them. With two postdocs involved, and, you know, they were instrumental in setting it all up. I remember very basic training, like teaching them how to respond to paddles and things like that, you know, literally shaping that behavior from zero, you know, learning to, you know, come to station, learning to, you know, make choices on a left or a right paddle. So I was involved in that. And then eventually once they came under control of sounds. With the Akea Kamai, it was a gestural language that we were teaching her, you know, using hand gestures like a normal marine animal trainer would use. But with Phoenix, we were using these underwater sounds. So I actually got to see the very beginnings of that language training, you know, mapping sounds and gestures onto objects, for example, or sounds and gestures onto actions. So, you know, I was, you know, by the time I stopped working with those dolphins, you know, we were all the way up to, you know, Akea Kamai, you know, fetch, frisbee, you know, left, whatever, you know. So Akea Kamai would go and choose the frisbee and take it to the left station there. It was exciting because that was at a time when also the chimpanzee language thing was catching a lot of attention. And Coco the gorilla was just starting up with the American Sign Language. So we were part of that whole, you know, animal language community, and we had, you know, very high hopes that, you know, we were going to, you know, push that frontier pretty far. And I think of all of them, I think the dolphins were probably one of the most impressive species, the complexity that they were able to show.
Absolutely. And so for those of our listeners who don't have, you know, an animal training background or are listening and thinking, okay, so you got a dolphin to fetch, you know, so what? I get my dog to do that. What do you think was so groundbreaking about this? I mean, we're talking about, you know, language acquisition and putting meaning together. Can you elaborate a little bit more about how important this work was?
Well, they learned, you know, all we were doing is putting together a sequence of gestures, and the sequence of gestures implied syntax, just like placement of words and sentences defines a subject, a verb, and an object. So we were, I mean, at its most complex, or at least, you know, fairly far along, we were able to say, you know, Akea Kamai, fetch, bottom, basket, top, frisbee. So there would be an array of, you know, objects in her environment. And, she would search out she'd go to the bottom basket, not the top one that was floating, and then bring it up to, you know, not the frisbee that was down on the bottom, but the one that was up on top. She even knew left from right. She could, you know, she could even fetch people. You know, that was one of the more impressive things. We would give her novel commands, things that she'd never heard before.
Sure.
Or seen before, say, like, you know, Akea Kamai, fetch bottom basket, you know, left person. And there'd be a person floating on the left, a person floating on the right. And she, you know, without even hesitation, even though it's the first time she was fetching to a person, she would go down, grab the thing, come up, you know, and bring it over to the left, you know, left person. I mean, so she, it was, you know, the similar complexity to human language, you know, the position of that word, you know, would determine, you know, whether it was the thing she was supposed to move or the object, you know, at the end of the process.
Sure.
Very impressive.
And to your knowledge, I mean, was that work continued on, or did that inspire further dolphin language or syntax work?
Well, there was, you know, other stuff going on. I know at Epcot Center at Disney, for example, they were doing similar kinds of stuff. But the Koala Lab really took it further, and I think more convincingly than any other place that, you know, tried to imitate it. You know, Lou just had refined it so well and had these animals trained so well. Yeah, it was, you know, it was very impressive work. And I heard Hannah discussing, you know, that they were even able to transfer control of the language over to, you know, little TV monitors. So Keiko Mai would watch these little hand gestures that are on a tiny little screen. And even though it wasn't the full-sized actor, you know, human in front of her, she could still figure out what that little TV image was saying. Amazing, amazingly robust and highly transferable. It was, you know, it seems like a miracle now that it ever happened. But it was, you know, at that time, it was just daily life at the lab, just watching these extraordinary things.
And is there anything you do in your work today that you accredit to this time that you had with Dr. Herman in the lab?
Well, today, I mean, when I got my PhD in 84, you know, with Dr. Herman as my advisor, I kind of graduated from dolphins to whales. I've been doing work with humpback whales ever since. And so a lot of the techniques that I learned in doing, I was director of his field project, you know, humpback whale project in 1985, 86, and then again in 93. So now since, you know, in the 21st century, for the most part, I've been doing work, humpback whales and their response to Navy mid-frequency sonar. I mean, that's the work I do today. But we're using a lot of the same techniques, you know, like focal follows and, you know, shore station observation and stuff that I learned when working with Dr. Herman. And I should also point out, I think one of the remarkable things about the lab and Dr. Herman is he was a beacon for, you know, all these interested people, but he was very good at aggregating these high-level talented people. I mean, all the people that, you know, all the graduate students and so on that worked with him have gone on to do extraordinary things. So I still work with those people.
Yeah.
So a lot of the folks that I work with in my research, you know, are alumni of the Kwal Basin Marine Mammal Lab.
Absolutely. So. And I think that was obvious too. When we had that gathering in 2015, that I believe was your idea.
It was my idea, right?
See the extent of talent that had come through the lab and the people that were still in the field. So tell me a little bit about the, I'm going to say this wrong, Festschrift, is that right?
The Festschrift, it's a German word. It just literally means like a celebration. A schrift is something you write. So it's basically like a celebration publication kind of thing.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's done. I'd only been to one similar one when Ron Schusterman was retiring. We had a Festschrift for him. But the idea is that it's like a mini conference that you pull together, you know, involving the people that the honoree has worked with in the past and, you know, rehashing, you know, representing some of the, you know, seminal findings from that laboratory. And that's what we did with Lou. But it turned into as much, not only the scholarly stuff he did, but also some of the, you know, the personal memories and so on. I think we are actually working on putting together a written publication based on that. On the Festschrift, I think it was, you know, in March, as I recall, of 2015. But it was wonderful. I mean, for those of us, I mean, you'll remember too, I'm sure, that, you know, we brought together people that had been working with him since the 1970s all the way up to the present. So there were people in the room who I'm seeing for the first time in, you know, over 30 years. it was just wonderful to have everybody be there and to celebrate his accomplishments and celebrate his life. And, you know, particularly poignant now in light of the fact that, you know, it was just a year before his passing. So he was totally surprised. We meant it to be a surprise event. And he just, you know, I think it crowned his decade, if not more than that. He was so flattered and so humbled that everyone would assemble like that to honor him. And as a result of that, Hannah Herman tells me that, you know, Joe Mobley, you can do no wrong. So I'm going to cash that card at some point.
Well, that's a good card to keep
good
with you.
Good card to keep with you.
Absolutely.
Right. That was great. It's sweet of her to say.
It was. And, you know, there's so many amazing stories and amazing memories. And one of them I heard outside of the context of the Festschrift was about Humphrey, the Wrong Way Whale, which, you know, takes us back a little bit to, I think it was like 1985. But can you elaborate on that story? Because I think that's just such a great story to close with this segment.
Yeah, I love that. That was one of the magical times, too. I mean, it transferred from the Dolphin Lab out into the waters off Maui. I was co-principal investigator with Lou on a, you know, it was an Earthwatch project where we got the idea that we would play sound underwater to humpbacks, you know, off West Maui. And we'd heard from, you know, there was one other publication that showed that sometimes, you know, they find sounds attractive. So we decided, okay, that was when they played songs. We decided, okay, let's play humpback whale song as, you know, one sound stimulus that we'd play to them. Let's also have a control. So we'll have a blank tape to make sure that, you know, it's not just the presence of the boat and speaker that they're responding to. Let's also have a synthetic sound. And let's throw in, just because why not, this feeding call that Scott Baker had recorded up in southeast Alaska the summer before in the context of whales feeding together. And of all those, you know, and social sounds, I guess, was the fifth condition. So of the five sound conditions, remarkably, the feeding call, which normally you don't hear in Hawaiian waters, was highly attractive. It literally brought whales, I don't want to say stampeding, that's sort of overstating it, but moving very quickly at the surface. It was a behavior that we called rapid approach. So the first time it happened, you know, I'm sitting in the boat with about, you know, several thousand dollars of stereo equipment on board the boat, and this underwater speaker, you know, this Navy J-11 150-pound underwater speaker. And the shore station's talking to us, and they're saying, you know, Joe, there's an animal that has literally turned around. It's coming straight toward you, you know, fairly quickly. And so we're like, our hearts are beating. We're watching for this because we had no idea what it was going to do. And it came, sure enough, there's this whale moving at us with this bow wave in front of it. And at the last minute, it just dove under the boat.
Wow.
And when we looked under the boat, you know, I was all sitting on top of the equipment and the cooler, you know, trying to make sure that it didn't get splashed in some catastrophic thing. But when we looked underwater, it had stopped and was posing next to the speaker, sort of like the old Victrola master's voice thing, you know, the dog next to the speaker. And just kind of check out where that sound was coming from.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, word of that got out. I mean, we were subsequently, I'd say we were able to show empirically that about a quarter of all the whales that were within 3 kilometers of us when we played that sound came, you know, swimming rapidly up to the boat. So we showed it to be a highly attractive sound. So when Humphrey, the wayward whale, he was in the news getting stuck, like, you know, some 20-some-odd miles up the Sacramento River, which was very, very odd, you know, that a whale would leave the marine environment and go way, you know, inshore.
Yeah, I don't think there are too many cases of that.
I mean, it's happened again since then, but that was the first time this really reached the public attention.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing all sorts of things like cracker bombs and banging pipes in the water, you know, scaring this poor animal. But someone got the idea, I think it was Lou in a conference call. He was like, hey, you know, we got this sound that we've been using out on Maui that's highly attractive. We could, like, send it to you and see what the heck happens. And so we sent, I remember, you know, sealing the FedEx envelope with a copy of the tape and sent it out to them. They basically, you know, reenacted kind of like what we did. They stuck an underwater speaker underneath the lead boat, and sure enough, you know, for I was the only thing that got Humphrey to start moving back, you know, back down towards the bay. He followed that boat all the way out into San Francisco Bay, and then there's this remarkable photographs of this humpback whale underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, just, you know, spouting away, and it, you know, back out into the ocean onto safety. I mean, the follow-on to that is that Humphrey returned, I think it was a year or two later, back up into the, it's like he was nostalgic or something and wanted to return. But, you know, it was just this incredible thing. And I remember it was the day that Scott Baker was defending his dissertation, and Lou got up in front of the audience and said, by the way, they've just announced that Humphrey the whale has just crossed crossed under the Golden Gate Bridges out to safety, and that's due to a recording that, you know, soon-to-be Dr. Baker recorded, and so everybody stood up and applauded. It was just this incredible time.
That's an amazing story. I feel like we should preface that story with, we don't want anyone going out there now with humpback whale recordings and trying to.
I know. Yeah, we were worried about that. Subsequently, National Geographic Explorer heard about it as well, our involvement, and came out and filmed us, you know, on the Nat Geo Explorer series. So we had a whole 20-minute segment that was just focused on us. And that's one of the things we talked about. We're like, you know, if the whaling industry, for example, got a hold of this idea, it would just kind of make it a little bit even less sport. Well, I don't want to say it was just less fair than it already is. You know, with, they could be attracting whales up to, you know, to get slaughtered. And so, yeah, we definitely didn't want that.
Well, I'm glad it didn't turn out that way. Joe, thank you so much for being here today. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about humpback whales with Dr. Adam Pacht.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. We continue our memorial of famed marine mammalogist, the late Dr. Lou Herman. Last, we have close colleague, mentee, and friend, Dr. Adam Pacht. Adam is a professor at the University of Hawaii Hilo and chair of the psychology department. He has worked with Dr. Herman for over 33 years. Now, we had both Dr. Herman and also Joe Mobley talk about their experience, and I'm happy to have Dr. Pacht with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly. It's good to speak with you again.
Yeah. Now, Adam, we had both yourself and Dr. Herman back in 2012, if you believe it, on the show talking about your humpback whale work.
That's right. It seems like it was yesterday.
It does go by very fast, and so happy that we were able to have Dr. Herman on the show with you to talk about your work. I want to jump forward a little bit and look at so many publications and accomplishments the two of you together have produced. Is there one particular project that really comes to mind as maybe your favorite work that you've done with Dr. Herman?
You know, it's true that Lou and I published a lot together, and I'm forever grateful to him, you know, starting in the 1980s, and there are many, many projects. One of my favorites was showing for the first time that dolphins can see through sound. That is, we were able to show that a dolphin could immediately recognize the similarity between an object it inspected first through echolocation alone, and then that same object inspected at a different time through vision alone. It was the first time that had ever been done, and it was generated a lot of excitement. Even Robin Williams came and did a documentary with us in part on that work. Another favorite of mine was Lou, myself, and one of his other graduate students, Scott Spitz, developed a new technique we called underwater videogrammetry to measure the body sizes of humpback whales underwater in conjunction with their sex and their behavior. And using that technique, for the first time, we were able to show that larger females produced larger calves, that larger females attracted more male escorts than did smaller females. And we also learned that, as you might expect, mature females were very, very picky in who they associated with, preferring the largest males.
Well, bigger is better.
Yes, that's what we said. A bigger mother is a better mother, and bigger males are more attractive to females, yeah.
Interesting. And, I mean, you kind of glaze over measuring size underwater of these whales, but that is not an easy task to do.
No, it was quite exciting. It involves a snorkeler, you know, under a federal research permit, at the surface of the water, filming whales and trying to get positioned laterally to them. And then aside from the video camera, there's the snorkeler is equipped with a handheld high-frequency little fish finder, a sonar device, higher than the whales can hear. And by using that to measure the distance between the camera and the whale, and knowing the angle of view of the camera and also measuring the image on the camera itself on the screen, we were able to use those pieces of information and some trigonometry to determine body length of whales for the first time underwater. It was quite exciting, and it's revealed a tremendous amount about the relation of body size to humpback whale behavior, including the last paper that we published on that, which was that Dr. Herman took the lead on, which was showing that singers, both mature and immature, participated in the chorusing of humpback whale song in Hawaiian waters.
Interesting. That's amazing. And tell me a little bit more about the work you've continued with humpback whales. Are you still conducting this research, or have you ventured into new projects with humpback whales?
Well, no, the research continues. You know, there's for every paper that you publish, and every question that you believe you've answered, there's a zillion other questions that come up. And so there's a ton left to do. And so we continue that work. You know, in 1976, Lou pioneered the scientific study of humpback whales in Hawaiian waters. And through that created one of the longest ongoing studies of any whale species worldwide. And among other things, this included amassing one of the largest catalogs of humpback whale identification photographs and life histories of really any place in the world. So we continue that work today, both in Hawaii, and I continue it also up in Alaska, where Lou started his work with his graduate students in 1980. I wasn't even at the lab at that time. That went from 1980 to 87. And then in 1997, I started going up there myself, and believe it or not, photographing some of the same whales and some of the same waters he first photographed years earlier. Now we're following individual whales now for 30 or more years, following their life histories as they, you know, go about their lives both in Hawaii and Alaska, and it's quite remarkable. So I'm happy to continue that adventure that he started so many years ago, and, you know, in the pursuit of knowledge about these remarkable animals, and move that forward.
Excellent. And do you still do you have ties with the humpback whale researchers in Alaska? I mean, do you guys talk about your work together?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, over the years, Lou's published with many of those researchers up in Alaska, and some of them were like Chris Gabriel or former graduate students of the laboratory. Others were collaborators like Fred Sharp and Jan Straley. And so, you know, it's a very, when you pare it down to the people who have longevity in this field, it's quite a small community of people who study humpback whales in the North Pacific. And so, yeah, we maintain great relationships with these folks. And just a year ago, actually, we sighted on our vessel the longest resight of any humpback whale ever in the world. It was about 44 years from first sighting to this final sighting, and that generated a lot of publicity, and so we collaborated on some of the radio programs and some of the media coverage with Jan Straley and Chris Gabriel on that.
That's amazing. 44 years.
Yeah, and that's not the age. I mean, that was just the span over which we had resighted the whale. Now we're learning that humpback whales, through some of the work Chris has done, that humpback whales may live into their 90s.
Wow, that's incredible. So moving a little bit away from whales, or maybe whales are a part of it, but I want to talk about the Dolphin Institute that you and Lou started in 93. I understand it's a nonprofit, but tell me a little bit more about what you did together with research and with students at the Dolphin Institute.
Happy to do that. In 1993, Lou and I, together with several friends from the community in Oahu, decided to form a nonprofit organization called the Dolphin Institute, which we dedicated to dolphins and whales through research, education, and conservation. And it was really through TDI that we were able to involve participants of all ages and college interns from all over the world in our research, in new studies of dolphins and whales under the banner of what we call TDI, and also through our education program, educated hundreds of Hawaii's keiki about the importance of dolphins and whales and also the protection of their marine habitat. One of my favorite projects that we conducted through TDI many years ago was a federal grant in collaboration with the Bishop Museum to provide high school students on Maui with the opportunity to join our whale research team out there for a three-day period and to serve as research interns on the boat learning how to conduct focal follows of whales close up. And at our shore station on the hill near Olawalu, surveying the whales from shore, getting kind of that broad view. And also coming back to our field house to learn how you actually process the data after you've gathered it on our computers at our field house. Another favorite project, this is one of my favorites, through TDI, involved both Lou and his daughter Aaliyah in collaboration with National Geographic, their remote imaging department. And this was to study the underwater behaviors of humpback whales in competitive groups. So that's a single female with or without a calf and multiple males vying for access to that female, sometimes very aggressively. And this is believed to be an important group in the mating process, although nobody's ever seen mating. Anyway, within these groups, we deployed for the first time CritterCam, which is a suction cup video and data logging tag on male humpback whales, and to learn about whale behavior and communication and social interaction beyond what one could see, you know, snorkeling at the surface. And so we were successful for the first time in deploying CritterCam on humpback whales in any breeding ground. And among some of the things we learned was that competitive behavior just doesn't occur at the surface, but also at depth, as deep as sometimes 150 meters below the surface. Males were aggressing with each other. We also learned that the humpbacks are using the entire water column and sometimes even resting or rolling in the soft bottom substrate at the bottom, and that led us to communicate those findings and also gave us insight into, you know, that if you're going to protect these animals, you've got to think about the entire water column as well.
Amazing. I mean, so much that you've learned from all these studies. Is TDI still running?
Yes. The Dolphin Institute is still running, still going strong, and has its, you know, its members and still you know, continuing to explore humpback whale behavior and publish about that. And now we have one additional mission, which, of course, is raising funds for the Lewis M. Herman Scholarship Fund. And this is to a new fund to support student marine mammal research in the areas that were the focus and love of Lou's work, dolphin cognition and humpback whale behavior. So if folks are who are listening are interested in making a contribution to that fund and supporting student research, they could make a check out to the Dolphin Institute. And we have a P.O. box, which is P.O. box 6279 in Hilo, Hawaii, and 96720. Or simply they could email me at my email address, pack@hawaii.edu. But this is a scholarship fund that the Herman family has organized. It's near and dear to all of our hearts, and we really look forward to, you know, paying it forward by supporting the next generation of whale and dolphin researchers.
Now, Lou's had a lot of marine mammal students come through over the years, clearly, of what we talked about today, and even having some students on the show who have worked with Lou for so long. What advice do you think he would have given to this generation of, or new generation of students interested in doing marine mammal work?
Well, I think that, I think Lou would advise students, kind of like I do with my students at UH Hilo, to really develop a broad array of skills in bioacoustics, in genetics, in GIS mapping, and to take advantage of all the new technology that we have now that we didn't have in those early years, and to really be very broad in one's skill level so that you're attractive to lots of different, whether it's agencies or universities. I think the other thing that's important is Lou would emphasize to students that they should continually think outside the box, which is what he did in their pursuit of knowledge about dolphins and whales. He's, I would say without a doubt, he was one of the most creative beings I had ever met. And over and over again, that creative spirit and ingenuity was on display for Lou's students or colleagues that visited the laboratory, both in the dolphin and whale research. I don't know of anybody who could have, you know, if I think about it, could have on their own developed a artificial language system to really show for the first time that dolphins could appreciate semantics and syntax, the core attributes of any language, and understand sentences. I mean, that is so impactful worldwide. And I remember the first time when I was 20 years old, I came to the laboratory. Lou had invited me to be one of the first interns at the lab. And I, you know, had always dreamed of studying dolphin intelligence. But back in those years, there was no World Wide Web or, you know, it was hard to figure out any way of doing this. And then I found out about this laboratory, wrote a letter. Lou invited me to spend the fall of 1983 there. And I remember walking through the laboratory's doors and being led up to a tower and watching Phoenix, the dolphin Phoenix, and Akea Kamai understanding a sound-based language and a gestural-based language and carrying out these sentences. And it was remarkable, and it changed my entire life.
I'm so grateful for you, Adam, to share these memories with us today. We need to wrap up, but in two sentences or less, I know you've been working on an in-memorandum publication of Dr. Herman's life. Can you just share where we can find that and when that will be published?
Sure. It's an in-memoriam. It's going to be published in the journal Marine Mammal Science. It's been accepted for that. It involves not only myself, but Aaliyah Herman, Hannah Herman, and about 10 other co-authors, who many of whom are world-renowned experts in the fields of dolphin and whale research. And it's a real tribute to Lou Herman's remarkable life and all of his many, many, many achievements in studying dolphins and whales and all that he's left us. He was really an amazing giant in the field of marine mammal science, the likes of which we're really not likely to see again.
Well, I couldn't have put it better myself. And so I'd like to thank all my guests today for taking some time to share their stories and the impact that Dr. Herman had on their lives and the lives of others. I'll close in honor of Lou today with my monthly message. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.